Yesterday, when I spoke about government policies during World War I, I hope I gave you some appreciation for the range of actions the government took with regard to the economy at that time. Many of those actions had never been undertaken before by the U.S. government, and they served as precedents. They served as examples later for other policymakers in other situations. We'll see today that during the Great Depression, many policies the government adopted were variations on what the government had done during World War I. And that may seem strange, and if so, it should seem strange, because it was an odd kind of reasoning that led them to take those actions and to use war policies as an example of what they should do during a serious economic contraction. But I'll come to that in a minute. The end of World War I is one of those dates easy to remember. You know, some people don't like to study history, but because there are too many names and dates to remember. But you can all remember the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, at the time the armistice took effect between the two sides in that war. And I think it's fair to say that when the Germans agreed to the armistice, they did so under an understanding about the kind of peace settlement that would be made that was mistaken. They had been misled, probably deliberately misled, by the diplomats on the Allied side to believe that they would receive better terms than they actually received when the ultimate treaty was made at Versailles. And because the terms of the Versailles Treaty were so hard to swallow, many Germans became bitter about the outcome of the war and harbored a desire to get revenge. And so they had a chance 20 years later. In many respects, it's good interpretation to think of World War II not as a separate war, but as a resumption of World War I after a time out of 20 years. Because certainly the terms of the Versailles settlement created many tensions, many problems that would continue to boil unresolved until the new war began. Finally, some of them would have more definite resolution, but every war leaves new problems in its wake, and the Second World War also did, in many respects, leave new problems. So in a way, just as we talk about the 30 Years' War in the 17th century, we might talk about something like a 30 Years' War between 1914 and 1945. Now, for the United States, the end of the war seemed like a happy event. The American soldiers could come home from France. 2 million of them had reached France, and eventually, in the final months of the war, they had exerted some discernible effect on the course of the war. Indeed, one reason the Germans decided that they would settle when they did was that even though there were not many Americans there yet, they could look across the sea And imagine millions and millions of fresh, well-equipped soldiers coming from America, and they didn't like that expectation. So they made their settlement in 1918 before even more Americans arrived. Unfortunately for the United States, the soldiers brought something home with them besides wounds. They brought influenza. And in the year 1919, the United States experienced the last great epidemic of its demographic history. For a long time, you could watch a chart of the death rate. And if you looked at the death rate in the United States, it was tending to fall in the late 19th century. But every few years, some serious epidemic would occur, and you would see a little jump in the death rate as a result. So many people would die of smallpox, or often of diseases such as typhoid. But over time, the curve of the death rate smooths out. That's part of what demographers call the demographic transition. And in modern times, death rates are very stable. In fact, although we don't know what individuals will die next year, we can say with great confidence approximately how many individuals in total will die next year in any modern country. We're not disturbed by great epidemics anymore. But in 1919, the last visible spike in the death rate can be seen in the curve. So that was a small, unfortunate gift from Europe. But no doubt it would have reached America in some other way if the soldiers had not brought it home from France. For a little while, there seemed to be prosperity in the United States. The year 1919 seemed to be very prosperous. It was a reflection, in a way, of false prosperity created by the enormous increase in money circulating in the United States. Money created by Federal Reserve policies to make credit very cheap and encourage banks to increase their borrowing, and then having more reserves to make new loans and investments of their own, giving rise to additional money creation through the operation of the commercial banking system. In 1920, the Federal Reserve officials became worried about what they had been doing. They no longer had the same excuse that making credit very cheap and allowing money to increase very rapidly was their way of helping the government finance the war. The war was over now, and so they began to worry about inflation, which was growing a little greater each year. So they decided they would change their policies. When they did so in 1920, in a very short period, they raised the rate of interest they charged for funds lent to commercial banks. In the New York Federal Reserve Bank, they raised the rate from 3% to 7% in less than 1 year. Well, the result of that was that banks then found that it was very expensive to borrow from the Federal Reserve Bank, and moreover, they needed to repay loans they had made in the past. And so as they changed their lending policies and borrowing policies, they had the opposite effect on the money supply. And the money supply began to contract. Credit began to grow scarcer very suddenly in the United States. And the result of that sudden change in monetary policy was the creation of a fairly serious economic contraction starting in 1920 and extending for a year or more into 1921. The real gross domestic product probably fell by perhaps 4% in 1921. The rate of unemployment went up to 11 or 12%. But most of all, there was a very large deflation, a very large reduction in the overall level of prices in the economy. Prices at the wholesale level fell by some 60% in a single year. Now, if you were selling goods at wholesale, that certainly was a disastrous development. But from another perspective, the extreme flexibility of prices, and at that time also wages, flexibility downward as well as upward, meant that prices could be the adjustment mechanisms to changes in demands and supplies. And because the price system could adjust very quickly when wages and prices were very flexible in both directions, that business depression of 1921 did not last long at all. Within a year, the economy had almost recovered fully, and within 2 years, it had more than recovered fully. So by the year 1923, the economy was operating quite prosperously once again. And it continued to operate very well for the remainder of the decade of the 1920s. Afterward, people looked back at the 1920s and thought they had been extraordinarily prosperous. That there was never such a time of economic growth. And that was not true. The economic development of the 1920s was good, but not very much out of the ordinary for periods of rapid growth in the American economy. It was comparable to earlier periods of development that we could find in the 1880s or the first years of the 20th century. But it certainly looks good when people looked back from the depths of the 1930s later on. So they came to call that decade the Roaring Twenties. And it's always had since that time a kind of reputation as a time of almost hysterical good times. It's often represented by jazz music playing and people dancing the Charleston and those old-fashioned dances that are pretty wild for the old days. And girls in short skirts for the first time ever with thin blouses and low cuts and very daring fashions. People seemed to be losing their inhibitions in the 1920s. The sort of thing that you can see if you watch the movie Chicago. That's a very artistic representation of the myth of the 1920s. Like most myths, there's a grain of truth in it. There were cultural changes. There were things that hadn't been done before. It was a time when women could go out in public and smoke cigarettes and get away with it. They didn't have some Puritan or pilgrim beating them with a club. There was prohibition, which meant, as I told you before, that everyone was drinking and drinking heavily. Because no longer were they drinking beer or wine, they were all drinking distilled alcoholic beverages that had a lot more punch. So there was a lot of drinking. Gangsters were engaged actively in the black market, supplying booze, as it was called. Whiskey, rum, gin, whatever people could get or make at home in the bathtub. So it was a time unlike any previous one, but from the economic point of view, just a moderately prosperous decade. Some industries, even in the 1920s, were not doing well. Many parts of American agriculture were not in good shape. They had overexpanded their use of land during World War I in response to the high demands for wheat to win the war. They had put under cultivation lands in the prairie region of the West that had not been used for farms before because the land is dry there. It does not get much rain, and so agriculture is risky. But with wheat prices high, guaranteed by the government during the war, farmers were tempted to take the risk and make new farms in the western parts of Nebraska and the Dakotas and Kansas and in places previously used only for cattle raising. So those farmers found after prices had fallen in 1921 that they were unable to conduct farming profitably in those areas. Much of the South had agricultural problems as well. In the rural areas, the small banks that served the farmers often found themselves faced with bankruptcy. So each year, normally, several hundred small banks would go out of business, unable to make any money. So there were these dark spots even in the roaring 20s, but again, by and large, a period of prosperity, of innovation, of new consumer products. Americans began to buy automobiles and refrigerators and phonographs and radios. Radio was a new thing. The first commercial radio stations did not begin to broadcast until 1921, but by the end of the 1920s, radio had spread all over the country, and even people in rural areas had some kind of radio, and many radio stations had been established. And even when I was a boy, this will tell you how old I am, my family used to gather around the radio in the evening and watch it as we listened. It wasn't as much fun as watching television. The radio didn't move very much, but that's what we did. We gathered around as a family and listened to the radio, because for my parents that was truly an amazing thing. This had come along when they were already almost adults. And so they still found it remarkable. So this was all part of the 1920s, all part of the world that seemed suddenly to come crashing down in 1929. Now, the whole economy didn't come crashing down in 1 year. Indeed, 1929, if we look at the standard economic measures, looks like a very good year overall. If we look carefully, we'll find that aggregate economic activity actually reached a peak around the middle of the year in 1929 and then began to diminish. But in October, when the stock market crash took place, the first part of the stock market crash, people noticed that a great deal. Stocks had risen very quickly in price in the 1920s, especially in the late 1920s. In the last 3 years, 1927, 28, 29, stocks had risen very fast. This was what economists sometimes refer to now as a bubble in the asset market. A kind of price increase that, although economists still argue about whether it was a bubble or not, I think most of us do believe it was. It was a price increase far too great to be justified by well-founded expectations about the earnings prospects of the corporations. Americans have always been good at financial trickery. And in the 1920s, they invented some new financial tricks, especially tricks using holding companies. A holding company was a company that did not make anything, did not have any product. All it did was own shares in other companies. And then Americans invented the higher level holding company, the company that owned a holding company. And you can keep pushing that up as far as you want to, but every time you do that, you create a level of holding of assets that's more and more fragile, risky, subject to a drastic reduction in price the minute the underlying production company starts to falter. So that if you had a couple of holding companies and the basic company that produced radios or automobiles began to fall in its sales or its prospects for profits, then the holding company that owned it was affected even more. And the company that held its shares was affected even more. So these kinds of tricks work both ways. You can make tremendous profits from leverage, that is, from taking a small investment and controlling a large volume of assets, but they also collapsed very quickly on the downside. So that happened to many of these holding companies when the stock market began to fall in late 1929. And indeed, most of those holding companies quickly became completely worthless. Their stocks fell to a price of zero. They could not be sold to anybody. It was hard to sell stocks, even in production companies, for years afterward, and they could be sold only at steadily lower prices. So after that first drop in the stock market, there was a few months later a rally. Stock prices came back up part of the way. And that little rally that lasted for a few months is known to economists as the sucker's rally. Because if you were watching the market and it fell drastically and you were thinking, oh no, and then suddenly it started to come back again and you thought, oh, everything is okay. I'll hold my stocks. I won't sell. Maybe I'll even buy more. Well, that would have been a huge mistake in early 1930 to buy into the sucker's market, because it only lasted a few months and then the fall resumed, and the fall continued with very few interruptions for more than 2 years. Eventually, stocks in general lost approximately 80% of the value they had in 1929. So this became the most famous stock market debacle of American history, and people still worry about it. Every time we have a big drop in the stock market, people began to draw comparisons. How does this look compared to 1929 to 32? Try to see if we should be selling everything now before the worst happens. Well, most people were not directly affected by a stock market crash. They didn't own any corporate stocks. But very quickly, as the whole economy continued to contract, everybody was affected directly in various ways. And one reason this depression is called the Great Depression is not simply that it was a deeper contraction than any other in U.S. history, and not simply because it was longer than any other. It took more than 10 years before complete recovery occurred, but also great because almost everyone was affected. Not everyone lost his employment. Not everyone was unemployed, even at the worst time. But those who did not lose their job were afraid that they might, soon. So everyone was affected. Rich people were affected. They were the people that held most of those corporate shares that dropped so drastically. Poor people were affected. They were the ones most likely to become unemployed. Farmers were affected, not because they were unemployed. They continued to produce the same as before. But the price of farm products fell by approximately 60% between 1929 and 1933. So the earnings farmers received from their production dropped drastically. At the same time, the prices of goods they purchased, their supplies, their equipment, the payment of their taxes, the repayment of their loans, those things either didn't fall so much, or in some cases, they didn't fall at all. If you had borrowed money, for example, your agreement provided for a certain repayment of interest in money. But now you're repaying in money that has much greater purchasing power than the money you borrowed. So the real burden of debt repayment became very great in that period for anyone who owed money. So net debtors, people who owed more money than others owed to them, they were amongst those hurt the most, amongst those crying out the most for some kind of government salvation or relief. Real gross national product, domestic product, fell by approximately 30% from 1929 to 1933. 30%. Investment spending in real terms fell by almost 90%. Hardly any investment was taking place. Not even investment for making up depreciation. If a plant was wearing out, people weren't spending money to repair it. If a plant was becoming obsolete, they weren't spending money to modernize it. Investors were hardly spending any money at all. New projects almost came to a stop everywhere in the economy. What that meant, among other things, is if you were employed in some line of work connected with new construction or with planning construction or supplying construction, there was almost no demand for your labor. Engineers became unemployed so frequently that a very strange thing happened in the early 1930s. Some 5,000 American engineers left the United States and went to the Soviet Union to work, because Stalin was then undertaking his great industrialization plan, and he was building a lot of factories, building a lot of facilities. And so the Americans went, of all places, to the Soviet Union to find employment. That's how bad it was for them. Now, young people suffered disproportionately from unemployment, because when so many people were unemployed, anyone who wanted to hire a new worker could choose among a great variety of applicants, many of them with much experience, much training. So when young people came with no experience or no special or great training, they didn't stand a chance. People tell stories about jobs such as putting petrol in the tanks of automobiles at the gas station. Somebody was going to hire a man to do that job. You know, anybody can do that. We all do it ourselves now. It's self-serve. But in the old days, they always hired people to put in the fuel. And so a man was hiring someone to do that job, and he had a sign out, help wanted. And, you know, 100 men were lined up, waiting to try to get the job. So the employer went out and said, okay, everybody who hasn't got a university degree, drop out of the line. You know, you didn't need a university degree to put gas in a car. But an employer could demand anything in those circumstances because there were still some men standing in the line. There were still some overqualified men. Many people were doing jobs for which they were overqualified, and people without much qualification hardly got jobs at all. One of the effects of that was that it changed the ideology of a generation. We've found that those people who came to age of political maturity during the Great Depression are much more favorable toward government intervention in the economy than older people or younger people. Their experience had taught them that they had to look to the government for salvation because the economy seemed to be failing them. And of course, during that depression, many other people concluded the same thing. They looked around at how terrible everything was and they said, capitalism has failed. Now, of course, the socialists and the communist agitators who were running around trying to convert people were all singing the same song. They were saying, look around you. Capitalism has failed. We must turn to an alternative system that will prevent this kind of catastrophe. In the United States, communists and socialists, although they were quite active, the Communist Party was legal in those days in the United States, and so communists recruited as hard as they could, but they had very little success. The American people didn't seem to be much inspired by radical notions. They didn't have any interest in revolution. They were mostly just struck unconscious almost. They just sat looking around dazed, unable to comprehend what was happening. But as those conditions persisted for year after year, they became more and more desperate and more inclined to seek some kind of assistance from the government. So the unemployment rate eventually went up to almost 25%, depending on how you compute it. That top chart there shows the rate of unemployment by the standard measure, adjusted for people who were working in government jobs during the 1930s. They're not counted as unemployed. Even then, however, you see that the decade of the 1930s is the only one with those extraordinary high rates of unemployment in the United States. The lower chart shows the path of gross national product all the way from 1869 to 1991. So it's a very long term. And what you can see from that distance is that, in general, economic growth has proceeded in a fairly smooth way in the United States. There are only two places where there's a large deviation from trend. And the only large negative deviation is the decade of the 1930s. The only large positive deviation is during World War II. And I'll talk about that tomorrow. That's actually an illusion. That's a statistical artifact. It's not real. But what you see represented here for the 1930s is real. There was a great shortfall of production during that decade, and it's not until after the end of the decade that we get back up close to where the trend line would be if we drew one in this chart. So this is a remarkable experience. There was nothing like it before. There's been nothing like it since. It's kind of the model of economic catastrophe, and people often hearken back to it when they write about gloom and doom. There's always a market for books saying that in just a few years the world is going to collapse. We have a lot of those in the United States, and if they're well written, they often sell many books. I think that their authors never know what they're talking about, and that doesn't mean economic catastrophe can never happen again. It's simply a fact that these writers don't know what they're talking about. But they always want to make people believe that something like the Great Depression is going to happen again next year or in 5 years, unless something is done. They sometimes have a plan. Well, by 1933, everybody was desperate. Businessmen were desperate. For 3 years in a row, corporations as a group had lost money. Corporate profits for all corporations together were negative in 1931, 32, 33. That doesn't mean that every single company was losing money, but companies as a group were losing money. Nothing like that ever happened before or since. And that meant that it wasn't just unemployed workers that were desperate. Capitalists were desperate too. They wanted some kind of help, bailout, some form of relief to keep them from having even further losses, even further reductions in the value of their corporate shares. So they were asking for government intervention, and that was important because the managers of big business have much more political influence than unemployed workers. So that was important. But there were so many people unemployed that they too had importance. And they were unemployed all over the country. It wasn't something that affected just one region. Almost everybody was affected to some extent. This phenomenon was quite pervasive. The governments of the states and the local governments were demanding help from the federal government because their income had fallen. Their incomes came heavily from taxation of property. But property values had fallen drastically, and so the tax they collected on property had fallen drastically. They found it sometimes impossible to pay government workers. School teachers in many places received no pay for years. They were given notes saying, we owe you. We'll pay you. Or they were given something called warrants, a kind of notice of debt that they might exchange with storekeepers or with other people at a discount. So all kinds of expedients, all kinds of little innovations were created to help people get through this situation. But it was simply difficult for almost everybody, despite all of their best efforts. The problem seemed to be bigger than almost anyone could cope with. And eventually, everybody, businessmen, workers, homeowners, farm owners, state governments, they all agreed the federal government was their only hope. They looked around and they said, nobody else can get the resources required to help us. And so they elected Franklin Roosevelt president in 1932. Hoover, who had been president almost throughout the Great Contraction. Bad luck for him, you know, bad timing. He took office at the beginning of 1929. 6 months later, the economy began to turn down, and it kept going down throughout Hoover's entire term as president. Hoover took many measures to try to stem the economic decline. He got a reputation in America later as a man who did nothing, who believed in laissez-faire and just folded his arms and watched the economy get worse and worse. But that was false. He did nothing of the kind. He tried to use the government's credit to make loans in various ways to farmers and to businessmen who were failing. He tried to help the states so they would have some money to help the unemployed. He shut off immigration so the immigrants would not be coming in to take jobs that someone else might take if the immigrant had not appeared. He took many actions. He was actually the most activist president the United States ever had in peacetime. He was a Wilsonian himself, so he was a kind of progressive, even though he belonged to the Republican Party. There was a progressive wing of the Republican Party also, as well as progressives who belonged to the Democratic Party. So there was nothing odd about Hoover, and he did what he thought was proper at the time, but it didn't have any noticeable effect. So he was blamed for what happened. I think he actually deserves little blame, maybe some, because one of the measures he did take was to call conferences of businessmen and get them to agree not to allow money wages to fall for their workers. But if money wages were kept the same while prices were falling, that meant that the real value of wages was rising. And real wages are what determine supply and demand in the labor market. So when real wages were raised, of course, employers wanted to hire fewer workers than they otherwise would have wanted to hire. So these agreements to prevent wages from adjusting down probably caused the rate of unemployment to be greater than it would have been otherwise. But that was just one more thing that contributed to the contraction, and Hoover was not personally responsible for every bad policy that was taken. In 1932, the federal government actually took the very bad decision to raise taxes. And that was the worst possible time for taxes to be raised, because that just created an additional burden on businessmen and made it even less likely that they would invest or even continue to operate existing businesses. So many policies were undertaken during Hoover's term that were wrong. Tariffs were raised in a famous law called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act in 1930. Again, a terrible decision to raise taxes on imports meant that international trade was discouraged. And it also meant that other countries then retaliated by raising tariffs on American goods. So before long, the entire world was engaged in a trade war as countries jockeyed with each other to raise tariffs and depreciate their currencies, all trying to stimulate their exports and discourage imports that competed with their own production. So the upshot of that was that world trade failed dramatically all over the trading world, and the efficiency of the world economy fell. The international division of labor was damaged, and people were made poorer everywhere by these measures. Americans as well as many others. So Hoover had done some things, but we can't blame him for everything. He was not as bad as the man who followed him. Roosevelt, of course, anyone could have defeated Hoover in 1932. I could have defeated Hoover. He's the only man I ever could have defeated. But Roosevelt was elected, of course, and when he was elected, no one expected a great deal from him. He had never been a radical. He had never been an especially promising political figure. He had been Secretary of the Navy in Wilson's administration, and he had been governor of the state of New York for 4 years. So he had political experience, but he was not a great politician by the standards of 1932, and no one thought very much of him. They didn't think he was very smart. They didn't think he understood much. He certainly didn't know any economics. He was a genial man. He's a backslapper, a man who liked to make speeches and go around shaking hands. He was just a politician. And so he was called, after his election by one commentator, he was called an amiable Boy Scout who has no special qualifications for the office of the presidency, but would like to be president. So no one expected anything drastic to come of Roosevelt. But Roosevelt immediately surprised them all. Because this image he had of the backslapper, the handshaker, the amiable Boy Scout should have suggested to them that the one thing Roosevelt understood, even if he understood nothing else, was how politics works. Hoover was a terrible politician. He hated politics. He didn't like to go around and shake hands. He didn't even like to smile. He was a very dour man. He looked unhappy all the time. And when he was president, he was unhappy all the time. But Hoover was a bad politician, and he didn't like politics. Roosevelt was exactly the opposite. He loved politics. That's how he wanted to spend his time, was making deals, telling lies, breaking promises, twisting arms, threatening, doing all the things that politicians in power do from day to day. And so immediately after his election, he took actions that shocked everybody. The first thing he did on the first day was to close every bank in America. This was called a bank holiday. And it lasted from March the 6th to March the 9th. But it would not end until he either approved the reopening of a bank or changed his declaration. And what happened was that federal inspectors were sent out to inspect the books of the banks, and only when they said this bank is in good shape was it permitted to reopen. So it took months for the banks to reopen fully. And some of them never did reopen because the inspectors looked at their books. They said, this bank is unsound. Its assets are already worth less than its liabilities. So it should never be operated again. And it was not. So already thousands of banks had failed during the early 1930s. And as a result of this bank holiday and the federal inspections, thousands more were closed. Now, a modern economy depends heavily on its financial system, certainly on its commercial banks. People keep their accounts there. That's how they pay their debts. That's how they settle their transactions. And when all the banks were closed, people could not do normal business, any kind of business. So the economy was thrown into a kind of limbo. It couldn't do much of anything but wait for the banks to reopen and hope Roosevelt wouldn't do something else crazy. But in a way, as crazy and as drastic as this action was, it shocked people, and it showed them that Roosevelt was prepared, he was willing to take drastic actions. If they had listened to his speech when he took office, they would have known that. Because in that speech, he said that the country should react to this emergency just as it reacted to the emergency of the war. And he used the analogy of war again and again and again. He said, we must submit to leadership just as we did during the war, and I am ready to lead you. Yeah, he was ready. One thing about a crisis, there's always a politician who's ready to lead us to salvation. No matter how crazy his ideas, someone is willing to take the reins of power if they are available. Roosevelt was willing, eager even. Very quickly, the federal government took one emergency action after another. When Congress came back to Washington, D.C. and went into session again, it remained in session for 100 days. And this period of a little more than 3 months is often noted as the most active period of lawmaking in American history. Tremendously important laws were made suddenly, with very little preparation, sometimes no debate at all, no discussion. Sometimes the members of Congress would vote for a proposed bill without reading it. Their leaders would tell them in some vague way what the bill did, and they would shout out, "Yay! Yay!" As opposed to "nay." That's how we vote in America. Yay or nay. Czechs can understand the nay. And so a lot of this legislation was made on faith. Now, it didn't come from nowhere. Someone had written it down. Someone had composed these bills. And when we look back at who did it, we find that all of these people who were desperate for some kind of government assistance had been putting together their bills. They had their lawyers, their experts writing down proposed legislation. And when they saw their chance, they rushed it to the Congress and said, "Here, pass this." And Congress did. You see, normally in the political process, people are in conflict in many ways. Things that are done to help you may have a negative effect on me. So we'll have a difference there, and any legislators who represent our interests will oppose one another. But what happened in 1933 seems to be that everyone was so desperate for government assistance that they made a kind of unwritten agreement. I won't block you, and you can get the law you want if you won't block me and I can get the law I want. We'll all get what we want at once. The Americans have a name for this kind of arrangement. It's called log rolling. And often there's log rolling, but not on this grand scale. Usually it's much smaller. You know, the urban interests agree with the farm interests on some piece of legislation, and then later on the other side gets what it wants. But this was the biggest log roll in American history. We had this huge outpouring of new laws doing all kinds of things. I'm not going to say much about the railroad legislation. Normally we would think it was important, but in the context of this situation, it doesn't seem like one of the most important things. The railroads were already heavily controlled by the federal government as a result of their takeover during World War I and the conditions for their return to private owners in 1920. So they did not have much independence as private property owners. They couldn't add to or subtract from their network of rail lines without government approval. They couldn't sell securities without government approval. So there wasn't a lot done, a lot remaining that they could ask for in 1933, but they still asked for some help, and they got it. So we had this Emergency Railroad Transportation Act that provided for even more federal regulation. And we had another law to assist the labor unions in the railroad industry. Though those unions had always been especially troublesome. They were always going on strike and trying to hold the economy hostage. And so this was kind of the final piece of it, attempt to tame them, to get them under complete government control and make them something more like government employees. The labor situation was in some ways the one that was most serious because of the high unemployment. One of the first things done was the federal government provided for direct relief. It established something called a Federal Emergency Relief Administration. And this agency gave large loans to each of the states for making payments to unemployed people so that they could have some income while they were out of work. In the winter of 1933, there were still so many people unemployed that the government thought, we have to do something more right now, or these people aren't going to survive through the winter. So they created another agency, an emergency agency, so to speak, and this operated only during the winter in 1933-34, and it hired men to do make work, to do jobs, you know, like raking leaves in the public parks and other things that normally wouldn't have been done at all, or certainly there would not have been millions of men hired to do jobs like that. But the government just needed an excuse to make payments to these unemployed people so that they would have some income to get them through the winter. In 1935, let's see if I actually have this on another display. I don't, but in 1935, a relief agency called the Works Progress Administration was created, and a large sum of money, $5 billion, which was very large amount at that time. It was more than 5% of gross domestic product. That large sum of money was just handed to the president for the use of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. And it was another make-work program. But it would go around the country and cooperate with state and local governments to decide, you know, what we could do to put men to work on building public projects, building a new post office, building a new park, building a new airport, building sidewalks in a city that had no sidewalks by the street, all kinds of things. It used to be that if you were very depressed, you were always aware of the WPA, Because if you walked along the street with your head down, like that, at the corner you would see these little marks in the concrete. And that told you that this was a sidewalk built by the WPA in the 1930s. They built miles and miles of sidewalks in America, many streets. They not only built post offices, but WPA hired not just common workers, but they also hired educated people. They had one project for actors. They had one project for artists. They had a project for people who put on plays, you know, because these people were all unemployed too. So the WPA was an all-purpose work relief program, and it became notorious as a place where you could see men just standing around loafing, not working very hard. I put a little piece of bad poetry in one of my articles written by someone mocking the WPA workers and how they were just a lot of loafers who were getting paid for no real work. And there was certainly something to that, but they did ultimately build many things. Some of these artists they employed didn't just put up a post office, but they painted inside it large murals. And these old post offices are still in use in some places, and you can always tell a WPA post office by the mural, because it's in the style of what we call socialist realism. It shows these really strong, healthy workers doing something with their muscles bulging, and you know, everything looks gloriously constructive, and you know, big positive things are being done here, and it's in bold colors. They're really quite interesting. You should go and do a Google search for WPA art. I'm sure there's some websites where you can look at these things. Very nice indeed. This was part, in a way, of the government's mixing work relief with propaganda, just as the communists like to mix, you know, artistic propaganda in with their efforts. So we have these work relief programs, but we also have a government now that's friendly to labor unions, and as a result, unions began to organize much more quickly. First, they were protected by some provisions in the National Industrial Recovery Act. I'll speak about that in a minute. That was passed in the 100 days session of 1933, but it required all employers to bargain collectively with their workers, and it guaranteed workers that they could freely select representatives to bargain for them, and that was a big official encouragement to the formation of unions, because it prevented employers from taking hostile measures to discourage workers from joining unions. And in 1935, the Wagner Act, as it's usually called, known as the National Labor Relations Act, strengthened those provisions. And from 1935 on through World War II, unions had their fastest period of growth in American history. They expanded much quicker in that period than any other. And it was because the government was making conditions very friendly for them to organize, and it was also hostile toward employers in many cases. The agency that supervised these elections, where workers voted whether they wanted to form a union, is called the National Labor Relations Board. It still operates. We still have the Wagner Act as amended as part of U.S. law today. And the National Labor Relations Board was very partisan. Under Roosevelt, it was hostile to employers and almost always made rulings that favored the unions. So that greatly assisted the unions in organizing workers and forcing employers to bargain with the unions. In the old days, they often just refused. They said, you know, you got a union? I don't care. I'm going to bargain individually with any worker who comes in here looking for a job. Get lost. But under the Wagner Act, they could not legally tell a union that was certified by the election procedure to get lost. They had to bargain whether they wanted to or not. So that was a big promotion of unions. And of course, unions became one of the major supporters of the Roosevelt administration. So that was good because not only did the union members vote for Roosevelt and his party, but their families and their friends and other people were influenced also to support the Democrats. And Roosevelt in 1936 was reelected by a huge margin, and one of the reasons was that this support he had given to unions helped get out a lot of new voters in his favor. So we have these new labor laws. When the National Industrial Recovery Act was found to be unconstitutional in 1935, immediately the labor provisions were reenacted and strengthened in the Wagner Act. And later on, this Fair Labor Standards Act was passed with some other reenactments, and providing for minimum wages, maximum hours, requirements that overtime work be paid at 1.5 times normal wages. Working conditions had to be decent, according to government inspectors. So these labor provisions have been the basis for American labor law ever since that time. These laws, the Wagner Act, with some amendments later, and the Fair Labor Standards Act are all still part of U.S. law. So there are many things done at this time as emergency measures, done because we had a depression, but they weren't repealed when the depression ended. They remained. They amounted to what I call a ratchet effect, an effect for government power to grow in emergencies and not to come all the way back when the emergency is over. In agriculture, there was great desperation, and Congress passed a tremendously important piece of legislation called the Agricultural Adjustment Act. This provided for payments to farmers for various things. One thing was that if they agreed to take some of their land out of production, then the government would pay them a rental for land that was left unused. And you might think, okay, we've got a lot of people who can't get enough food. Why are we taking land out of production now? Well, this was an example of something that happened in many different policies. People thought the depression is because prices have fallen. If we can do something to raise prices, we'll end the depression. Now, that makes a kind of sense on an individual level. If you're a farmer and you can get a higher price for your product, well, that certainly helps you if everything else remains the same. If you're a businessman and you can get a higher price for your product, that certainly makes you better off. But what they knew is that you could raise prices by restricting market supply. So they're restricting market supply in agriculture to raise agricultural prices. They're restricting in industry with the National Industrial Recovery Act they're restricting production so that industries will be able to sell their products at higher prices. But think about this. If everybody is restricting production, well, that's the very definition of a depression. This policy was incoherent. It did not add up. Although it made sense if you looked at one person or one industry and kept everything else the same, it made no sense if you used this kind of policy for everyone simultaneously. And that's in large part what the New Deal tried to do. It tried to raise everybody's prices all at once. Its monetary policies were aimed at the same objective, and they were even crazier. So we have this Agricultural Act. It too was found unconstitutional in 1936, but as soon as it was found unconstitutional, Congress went back and made new laws that brought most of it back again. So the farmers were still being given various forms of federal relief. They were still being enrolled to reduce supplies. They were being forced to enter into marketing agreements to restrict the amounts of certain crops that would be released onto the market for sale. And once again, we find that even today, although the agriculture program has been changed many times since the 1930s, these basic kinds of policies are still used in America. Farmers are still paid for supply restrictions. They still have their income supported in a variety of ways. They still have marketing agreements to keep people that grow lemons or oranges or raisins from just freely putting them on the market. They always have to channel them through a cooperative that has a limit on how much it can release onto the market. So these sorts of controls never ended. They probably weren't really intended to end. The agricultural interest groups that sponsored this legislation in the first place really wanted that kind of protection permanently. And they used the emergency as a good occasion to do what they had wanted to do for many years. And that, again, is typical. Emergencies are always the opportunity for people to accomplish through government what they cannot accomplish during normal times. Because government in emergency is not so constrained. There's not so much resistance to new programs or new powers. There's a greater willingness of people to all fall into line and make a big log roll. Since the attacks of September 11th on the United States, we've had huge log rolls in Washington, D.C., so that the federal government has increased its spending very rapidly, but it's not just spending for the armed forces. It's not just spending for the intelligence agencies. It's spending for everybody. It's spending for school teachers. It's spending for roads. It's spending for everything. The whole budget has gone up in a huge vote trading, because now people can be told, the public can be told, it's an emergency. The government has to spend more money because Osama bin Laden is trying to kill us. But when you look at what the government is doing, Osama has nothing to do with 90% of what the government is doing. It's just an excuse. But it works. It works because most people are badly informed. They don't pay attention to any details of what the government does. And so they accept the reasons that are given by politicians. And of course, people are all happy to get additional benefits from the government. It doesn't occur to them that altogether, we must all pay for this somehow. It's not the product of God. It's not falling like manna from heaven. Resources have to come from somewhere. They have to involve opportunity costs. And the government's current growth has to involve an opportunity cost. We will pay for it, directly or indirectly, sooner or later. Under Hoover, the government created a Reconstruction Finance Corporation that was modeled directly after a wartime agency, the War Finance Corporation. During the war, the government had used this agency to channel funds to companies that could not borrow money from the usual sources because the government was borrowing so much money during the war. It was chasing other borrowers out of the market. And so sometimes the result was that industries that were critical for the war were unable to expand their capacity or unable to modernize to produce war products. So the War Finance Corporation tried to fill that gap that the government had created by its own war financing measures. But that agency had continued for years after the war. It had finally been terminated in 1925. Now it was recreated and called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and used on a much bigger scale. This became the major spending agency for the Roosevelt administration. In the beginning, it mostly made loans to banks or other financial institutions or to railroads that were failing or in danger of failing to try to keep them operating. Eventually, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation made all kinds of loans. It even made investments. It purchased shares in companies so that we had a kind of small-scale socialization going on through the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And then during World War II, it became the major agency for the government's building of war plants and other war measures that were even bigger still. So this was a kind of Frankenstein monster that was killed every few years and then revived. And every time it was revived, it was 10 times bigger than it had been in its previous life. And it never was totally killed. The name Reconstruction Finance Corporation was given up in the early 1950s. And the agency was replaced by something called the Small Business Administration, and that has been operating ever since, making cheap loans to businesses that cannot get loans in the commercial market because they don't deserve loans. They're not good business prospects, and bankers are not willing to lend to them. But the government doesn't care because this is a way of buying votes for the government, to go around providing this kind of handout. So the Reconstruction Finance Corporation continued to operate, bailing out failing businesses. The National Industrial Recovery Administration was the greatest economic experiment in our history in many ways. What it tried to do in order to raise prices for industrial goods was basically to create a cartel in every industry. We all know that cartels can charge higher prices than a lot of competing firms can charge because they suppress competition. They coordinate everybody. They may close some plants. They restrict supply. And therefore, they can sell their products at a higher price. So the idea here was to cartelize every industry in America through something called codes of fair competition. Now notice that. What the government is doing here is destroying competition. And it's describing its efforts as fair competition. If it had been honest, it would have called these codes of no competition. But it was not honest. It usually is not honest. And this was one of the most dishonest things it ever did. to create these codes. They varied from one industry to another, but every one of them had the same objective: to suppress competition, to restrict supply, and to allow sellers to charge higher prices. So these things were hastily put together. Eventually, about 750 of them were written. And if your industry was stubborn and didn't write its own code of fair competition, the government lawyers would write one for you and impose it on you. So you knew that it was in your interest to get people together and write a code of fair competition. And in practice, it was the big businessmen who did this, and the smaller firms didn't have much to say about what was done. It was supposed to involve consumers and workers, but that was a bit of a joke because the workers never really had much to say about the codes, and the consumers, of course, had nothing to say about them because all of these codes were anti-consumer. They were aimed at making prices higher and hurting consumers as a result. So it was a good thing when this law was declared unconstitutional in 1935, but immediately after it was declared unconstitutional, once again, Congress got together and reenacted parts of it, parts that they thought would get by the Supreme Court. And indeed, many of those little parts they recreated did get by the Supreme Court and have been around ever since, sometimes with later amendments. So we had this tremendous cartelization experiment. It was a flop. It was a failure economically. It did not revive the economy. A good economist would never expected that it would. Like many of the experiments the Roosevelt administration tried, this was not based on good, sound economic advice. It was based on interest group maneuvering covered over with a thin layer of economic excuse to make it sound as if it had some reasonable economic basis when it really did not. It's true that many people were confused at that time. Even economists weren't quite sure what was going on and what should be done. But not all economists were confused. There were some that would have understood immediately that the National Industrial Recovery Act would not get the economy out of the Depression. Indeed, it would help to keep it in the Depression even longer than it would have been. Well, we have other things, but I've run out of time for today, and I may say a little more about them when we meet tomorrow.